We seem to find ourselves in the midst of increased polarization. Polarization of argument, polarization of opinion, polarization of value. What's the role of rationality in a polarized context? What should the role of rationality be? On a more individual level, is it possible to have a rational discussion with people who seem to disagree with you so radically on such fundamental issues? Is it possible to cut through? Is there a way for rationality to reduce polarization? That's what this lecture is about. I want to start with the facts about polarization in America, but first it's important to make a distinction. What I'll call partisan polarization is polarization between political organizations on the scale of either major political parties or smaller interest groups. What I'll call cultural polarization is polarization within the general public on attitudes that may or may not be expressed politically. First, the bad news. Partisan polarization is real. In 1980, only 43% of Americans polled said they thought there were important differences between the parties. The figure is now 74%. In 1976, almost a third thought it didn't even make a difference who was president. That figure is now cut in half. Internal uniformity within each party has grown just as distance between them has. There was a time when members of Congress often crossed party lines. Between 1969 and 1976, the Nixon and the Ford years, the rate at which Republicans voted along party lines was about 65% in both the House and the Senate. The same was true of Democrats. Between 2001 and 2004, under George W. Bush, Republicans voted with their party 90% of the time. Democrats voted with their party 85% of the time. Partisan polarization like that isn't new. George Washington's farewell address in 1796 emphasized the danger of factions. Quote, "One of the expedients of party to acquire influence is to misrepresent the opinions and aims of others," he said. "The spirit of party kindles animosity and agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms." A year later, Thomas Jefferson complained that because of partisan polarization, men who have been intimate all their lives cross the streets to avoid meeting. Sound familiar? Jefferson observed it, but he didn't reverse it. Until the very last part of their lives, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams treated each other in precisely that way. Partisan polarization has increased over the last few decades, but there's also some good news. Cultural polarization, polarization in general social attitudes among the general public, may not have. Morris Fiorina, an expert on the topic, says that increased polarization is primarily a political phenomenon. Partisan polarization between political activists or within the political elite. But of course, it's the political activists and the political elite who make the news. We've noted before that media sources may lead us to overestimate the frequency of the dangerous events that appear in the news. The impression that not just partisan politics, but cultural views in general are polarizing may be a media effect as well. Polarization in public attitudes is limited to a few hot-button issues. On most issues, public polarization hasn't increased between groups, regardless of what groups are being compared. The young and the old, men and women, the more and the less educated, different regions of the country, or different religious affiliations. On a number of fronts, polarization has in fact decreased. Views on women's role in public life are no longer the hot-button issue they once were. Racial integration was once fought vociferously by major portions of the population, not now. Support for the death penalty has fallen, though opinions of crime have moved toward tougher enforcement. And those changes have operated in parallel across those different groups. It's polarization on a few hot-button issues that makes the news. Abortion and gay marriage are prime candidates. Views even on taxation, government, and the deficit are much less polarized than the politicians would have you think. Well over half of voters think that both spending cuts and higher taxes will be needed to reduce the deficit. So what explains the polarization we do see? Let me give the answer the political scientists tend to give, followed by some bits of data from the sociologists. Then I'll turn to the internal and logical dynamics of polarization, which is of particular interest to philosophers, the quasi-rational part of the picture. Political scientists concentrate on partisan polarization, of course. They note historical changes in the parties north and south. The Republican Party has drifted strongly to the right. Republican and conservative coincide much more closely now than in the past. In the Democratic Party, Northern Democrats have become somewhat more liberal than in the 1960s. More important is the change in the South. Southern Democrats were once an important voting bloc, different and in many respects less liberal than their Northern counterparts. That voting bloc now affiliates itself with the Republican Party. Sociologists add some observations regarding social and cultural polarization. Since the 1970s, we've sorted ourselves more residentially by income and social class. Our neighbors are increasingly like ourselves. Sociologists also note that America has a long history of fraternal and voluntary organizations. The Rotary Club, Lions, Kiwanis, Masons, Odd Fellows, the Elks. Local chapters often drew members from various occupational and class levels across the community. They brought people together with people who might not be exactly like them. But membership in those long-term organizations has waned, replaced with self-selecting short-term membership in groups organized for some single political purpose. Let me shift from political and social observation, however, to a philosophical analysis of the dynamics within polarization. When you think about it, it seems that a polarization of attitudes or opinions is to be expected. It may even follow something like rational lines. I'll follow our earlier strategy of going to extremes, exaggerating in order to present the issue as simply as possible. Suppose that Mr. Magoo is very much convinced of a particular opinion. He's just sure that that position is right. Because he's convinced that the position is right, he's convinced that any evidence offered against the position must be flawed in some way. Bad research, perhaps, or an improper interpretation. Because Magoo is convinced his position is right, he's convinced that any argument offered on the other side must somehow be a bad argument. It must rely on some trick or some logical fallacy, or go wrong just because of that flawed data. In the philosophical literature, Mr. Magoo is what's called a Kripkean dogmatist. The term comes from a lecture by the contemporary philosopher Saul Kripke. Mr. Magoo thinks a particular position is right, and that alone seems to give him reason to be suspicious of any counter-evidence, any counter-arguments. The position's right, so there has to be something wrong with anything that seems to go against it, even if he can't put his finger on what. Mr. Magoo is an extreme case. He thinks his current position is right, and on that ground is prepared to reject any information to the contrary. Conspiracy theories seem to work very much that way. I'm sure you're too young to remember. The Beatles were at their height in the 1960s when the rumor started that Paul McCartney was dead, killed in a car crash in 1966. The evidence? Clues from the albums. In A Day in the Life, John Lennon sings, "He blew his mind out in a car. He hadn't noticed that the lights had changed." Aha! A reference to the accident. If you listen closely to John at the end of Strawberry Fields Forever, you can hear something that sounds like, I buried Paul. And what about the visual evidence? On Magical Mystery Tour, Paul's the only one wearing a black carnation. Aha! The Fab Four crossing the street on the cover of Abbey Road, John's dressed in white as the religious figure. Ringo is in black as the undertaker. George is in faded blue jeans. He's the gravedigger. Paul's the only one in bare feet, the corpse. It should be easy to refute a rumor like that. Just have Paul do an interview and show everyone he's alive. This is where the strategy of the Kripkean dogmatist comes in. Not so fast. If Paul's dead, that can't be real. Seems to me I remember a Paul McCartney look-alike contest run in one of the teen magazines, and the winner was never announced. Aha! There's still a Flat Earth Society, and there have been some serious Flat Earthers. In 1956, a spokesman for the society was asked about satellite images from space that showed the Earth as an oblate spheroid rather than a flat disk. His response? It's easy to see how a photograph like that could fool the untrained eye. Here's how this offers an analysis of polarization dynamics. Imagine two people strongly convinced of two opposing positions, Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss, perhaps. Both are Kripkean dogmatists. Both selectively reject evidence and argument against their position. Both are selectively receptive to evidence and argument for their position. Now suppose they're given a mixed bag of new evidence and arguments, just like we get on just about every topic every day. The new information includes a handful of evidence and arguments that seem to point in one direction, but also a handful that seem to point in the other. One might hope, that new evidence and argument would bring the two views closer together. But if we're dealing with Kripkean dogmatists, that's not what's going to happen. Magoo will look at the totality of evidence, reject the pieces on the other side, and accept those that favor his current position, thereby strengthening it. Dr. Seuss will do the same, rejecting exactly the opposite handful of studies and arguments, strengthening his position as well. Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss will become even further and more firmly polarized. There's nothing inherently polarizing about the handful of evidence and arguments they see. It may equally represent both sides. But if attitudes start out already polarized, it can make them even more so. Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss are the extreme case. They are prepared to reject all contrary evidence on the basis of their current positions. But that same dynamics will operate even when the case isn't that extreme. There are a set of classic studies in social psychology that show precisely this effect. Individuals' attitudes toward the death penalty were measured. Subjects who favored the death penalty were put in one group. Those who opposed it were put in another. Both groups were then given the same two pieces of evidence. One piece of evidence supported a claim of deterrence. It was, in fact, a study that compared murder rates for the year before and after the adoption of capital punishment in 14 states. In 11 of those 14 states, murder rates were lower the year after adoption. The other piece of evidence went against deterrence. This one was a study that compared murder rates in 10 pairs of neighboring states, where one state had the death penalty and the bordering state didn't. In 8 of the 10 pairs, murder rates were higher in the state that had the death penalty. Each group was also given further information on the two studies, experimental details, critiques in the literature, and the researchers' response to those critiques. So both groups studied the totality of evidence and were again asked about their opinions regarding the death penalty. The result? Just as you'd expect from Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss. All participants found the evidence supporting their position better conducted and less subject to criticism than the counter evidence. Both groups ended up indicating stronger commitment to their position than when they began. There's another dynamics in polarization that hasn't yet been strongly studied. My prediction is that it will get increased attention. In fact, I'm working on it in some of my own research. The issue is selection of information sources. There was a time when America had one basic television news source, the NBC, CBS, and ABC nightly news. Because of the canons of journalism, they tried to avoid an overt political stance. Walter Cronkite was repeatedly cited as the most trusted man in America. That time is past. We have Fox News and MSNBC clearly polarized politically. Instant access to any slanted source is immediately available on the internet. Now, not only will Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss treat identical information differently, they'll seek out information differently. Mr. Magoo will trust information sources that reinforce his existing beliefs. Dr. Seuss will do the same on the other side. Because both will be able to find media reinforcing their existing beliefs, we can expect polarization to increase. That's what the internal dynamics of polarization might look like. And you have to admit that there seems to be something rational about that dynamics as well. Suppose you do have reason to believe a particular position. Isn't that also reason to believe that the counterposition is incorrect? Isn't that reason to believe that arguments for the counterposition have to be wrong? Not only do we often reason this way, it seems we have to. We can't constantly reconsider every position on every issue from the ground up, given every new piece of information that comes our way. We have to put new information through some initial plausibility filter, simply in order to know what's worth paying attention to and what's not. That seems to be an essential mechanism, not just in everyday life, but in normal science. Not every wacky claim from every corner is given equal consideration. There are studies that are poorly done, trumpeting results that we have full reason to believe aren't right. Working scientists need an initial plausibility filter, too. What can we base that plausibility filter on, except the theories we think we already have good evidence for, or the opinions we're already sure of? What differentiates our case from that of Dr. Seuss and Mr. Magoo? The consensus in the philosophical community is that there is indeed something rational about the dynamics we've been talking about, but not enough to justify Kripkean dogmatism, not enough to justify Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss. Remember that the Kripkean dogmatist rejects any new evidence and any new argument. He's sure his position is right. Nothing you can offer him to the contrary is worth looking at. What that really means, however, is that he takes whatever originally led him to his current position to trump any evidence since. That's the irrational part. Everyone agrees that the rationality of a position depends on the total available evidence. Now, if you knew there were 100 pieces of relevant evidence on a topic, would you make up your mind on the basis of just 3 that you happened to come across first? No, that would be irrational. But that's what the Kripkean dogmatist is doing. Of course, people decide on positions for all kinds of reasons, many of which have nothing to do with the evidence. But let's give Mr. Magoo the benefit of the doubt. Let's assume that he really did come to the position he now holds by looking at available evidence. Even so, the evidence he used to form his view originally was a long time ago. It didn't include all the relevant evidence because it didn't include the evidence that's coming in now. That means that he made up his mind on the basis of some small sample of evidence, the evidence that happened to come his way long ago. That's what's irrational. Here again, Magoo is an extreme case, but the lessons carry over to more realistic setups as well. Suppose it wasn't just 3% of the relevant evidence that someone used to form their opinion. Suppose it was 30%. Suppose the person isn't totally impervious to new evidence from the other side. They just think they have grounds to be skeptical. That gives us a sliding scale rather than an all-or-nothing measure. Full Magoo-like irrationality comes with total imperviousness to new evidence on the basis of a position grounded in a very small or very ancient selection of the data. A position will be more rational the more data behind it, the greater proportion of the evidence that informs it. A position will be more rational the more it remains open to incoming information. If perfect rationality would demand being open to all evidence on all topics all the time, I suppose none of us can be perfectly rational. Our cognitive limitations are such that we have to do some filtering. That applies even to a social institution like normal science. We can still use the idea of an even-handed openness to new evidence as a rational ideal and a reminder to avoid becoming Kripkean dogmatists. There's a good warning indicator of when two people might be falling prey to the dynamics of polarization we've been talking about. Suppose you and a friend agree on lots of things. On all of those, she seems as perfectly rational as you do. She handles the evidence well. She's alive to subtleties of argument, a smart cookie. Not much gets past her, and I'll bet she thinks much the same of you. But her position on issue X just seems radically wrong. Stupid, even. How can she possibly think that? That's the warning indicator. It is hard to believe that someone so rational in other areas could be so irrational in area X. That's a sign that it's time to lay out evidence and argument on both sides, recalibrate, and reevaluate. There's no guarantee that like-mindedness will result. But strong disagreement in a small area with a person you think is generally rational is an indicator that you may be playing Mr. Magoo to their Dr. Seuss. How do we fix polarization? How do we try to have a rational discussion in a context that's already polarized? The literature on negotiation strategies seems to fit surprisingly well. William Ury and Robert Fisher are members of the Harvard Negotiation Project, authors of the influential Getting to Yes. Let me adapt some of their tips to the present case. A major theme in their work is removing an issue from its ties to emotion and ego. That applies here too. Rationality deals in cool-headed evidence and argument. To the extent that we have mere emotion on both sides, rationality doesn't have much of a chance. There's room for progress if both sides can say, wait a minute, I know we each feel strongly about this, but there is a real intellectual question at stake. Let's try to put the emotion aside and take a hard look at the issue itself. Ury speaks of this step back from emotional involvement as going to the balcony. The idea is for both sides to try to view the issue as if they were not embedded in it. Try to see it from a distance, as if the positions were being advanced by someone entirely different. That's an approach to polarized discussion that could be used unilaterally, but it's going to be more effective if both sides recognize that the issue is emotionally laden and both attempt to go to the balcony. A correlate theme is ego distancing. People identify with the views they hold. That's part of the problem. I'm arguing for my position. You're arguing for yours. But of course, neither truth nor rationality care whether a position happens to be mine or yours. Look, this isn't about us. If an issue can be cast as one for joint resolution through joint effort, that's a step away from individual ego. And it's clearly a step in the right direction. Public debate is not the best context in which to drop ego identification, even if it's around a table at Thanksgiving. That's a context in which people have too much to lose. So change the context. Let's agree on some quiet discussion together on a long walk. As long as a discussion is framed in terms of winning and losing, ego involvement is inevitable. That's why debates are probably not the best ways to arrive at a clear examination of an issue. Adversarial confrontation constitutes the public part of a criminal trial. But the real decision is made by someone else, in discussion, behind closed doors, by the jury. Professional philosophers have a major stake in logic and rationality, but I have to say that it's only been very rarely that I've heard a philosopher say in the midst of a public discussion, "Oh, I see. Yes, I was wrong. You're right." Much more often, the change of mind is made offstage. Somehow that helps. "You know, I've been thinking about your arguments yesterday. I've got a few questions, but I think you might be right." Ury and Fisher urge people to avoid positional negotiation. In positional negotiation, people identify themselves with specific positions from the start, positions to be won or lost. In positional negotiation, one seems forced into one of two roles. You end up either a soft negotiator or a hard negotiator, but neither of those really works. The soft negotiator wants to avoid conflict and so gives in. He often ends up feeling exploited, stepped upon, and bitter. The alternative is to be a hard negotiator, out to win and giving as little as possible every step of the way. In negotiation between hard negotiators, both start at absurd extremes, so that even if they do have to make a few concessions, they'll still be within their target area. One can expect that kind of negotiation to be a lengthy and drawn-out procedure. It might well break down. Positions don't get softer. Ego involved, emotionally driven, and with an emphasis on winning, hard positions just keep getting harder. What holds for negotiation holds for discussion in a polarized atmosphere as well. As long as the context is one of winning and losing, emotion and ego identification, one either gives in, feeling one has sacrificed truth, principle, or rationality to buy a little peace, or positions end up hardening to the point that they threaten the relationship itself. The alternative is to change the game. If the context can be changed from a contest of wills to a mutual exploration and investigation of an issue, then there's a chance. In leaving positional negotiation behind, Urey and Fisher urge people to look for a way to settle issues in terms of objective criteria. In the case of negotiation, that may mean an appeal to independent standards. Can't agree on the price for the house? What if we compare houses in the same area that have sold in the last 6 months? Can't agree on the depth of the foundation? Let's decide it on the basis of government specifications for these soil conditions. The idea is to ask in advance what would settle the issue, agree on that, and then appeal to it. The same thing can work with rational discussion. Once we've removed emotion and ego as much as possible, once we've gone to the balcony and are trying to view it as an issue for joint investigation rather than for ego-invested debate, let's try to agree on what might actually settle the issue. How would that work? The debate context is one in which opponents start with positions on, say, deterrence on the death penalty. If we can change the game, we have collaborators investigating deterrence in the death penalty. That allows us to look at the totality of evidence. But let's decide in advance. What kind of evidence should convince us that there is an effect? What kind of evidence should convince us that there isn't an effect? If we can do that, we can look with new eyes at what the evidence actually is. We can stop being Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss. We may actually reduce polarization. Sometimes the dispute isn't over data or evidence, but over background principles. There, discussion has to go deeper. One thing to ask is what principles are at play and what kind of principles those are. Proponents of gun control tend to emphasize statistics regarding harm. Opponents of gun control tend to emphasize constitutional rights. But if you take them out of the context of debate, people on both sides recognize that the Constitution says something important about rights. People on both sides recognize that we should avoid unnecessary harm. If we can get from polarized people to joint recognition that the issue is one of conflicting principles, we've made progress. There are several points I hope you'll take home from this lecture. First, some of the data on polarization. Partisan polarization is real, and the media emphasizes the hot-button controversies. When you look more generally at cultural attitudes and consider the population as a whole, it's not true that an enormous split is growing between us. I want you to take home the image of Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss, discounting evidence out of hand simply because it clashes with their existing positions. That dynamics is predictable. As a filtering device, it may even be rational. But rationality demands that positions be sensitive to the totality of evidence. It may be time to ask whether ours are. Finally, remember some of the tips toward rational discussion taken from the negotiation literature. There's no guarantee. But if we can go to the balcony, if we can pull the plug on ego, If we can change the game from confrontational debate to joint investigation, we at least stand a chance. Is rhetoric an issue here? Absolutely. We'll talk more about that next time.